good evening, and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, February 26, 2020. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho House Judiciary Committee Chair Greg Cheney announces gender affirmation ban bill will not move forward. Idaho House approves transgender sports participation ban bill. And University of Idaho Law School professor Richard Siemens outlines the legal aspects of 5G cellular rollout. It's all coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho House Judiciary Committee Chair Greg Cheney of Caldwell announced today the bill to make it a felony for doctors to provide gender affirmation treatment to people under the age of 18 in Idaho will not proceed further. Cheney made the announcement in a five-page letter to bill sponsor Republican Christy Zito of Hammett the day after an emotional hearing at the state capitol in which many people who spoke against the bill said passage of the bill would mean an increase in the already high suicide rate among transgender teens. One person testified legislators who voted for the measure would essentially be committing murder. Cheney said in the announcement that while he agrees gender reassignment treatment for minors is harmful and should be stopped, he was moved by the sensitivity of the issue to those who are struggling with it. Cheney wrote, "I found all of the 51 people who addressed the committee yesterday to be sincere and legitimately concerned for the welfare of our children." Meanwhile, the House passed another bill targeting transgender citizens today. By a vote of 52-17, the House passed House Bill 500, which would ban transgender girls and women from participating in school sports. The bill would also allow physical and chromosomal exams of athletes when someone challenges their eligibility to participate in sports. Democratic Representative Melissa Wintrow of Boise called the bill the child genital exploration legislation in a press release. Bill sponsor Republican Barbara Ehart of Idaho Falls told the House the bill uses the word may rather than shall regarding physical exams. However, an examination of the wording of the bill makes it clear either a physical exam, a test for testosterone levels, or a chromosomal test would be required if the challenged student were to continue with the sport. All House Democrats voted against the bill, as did Republicans Greg Cheney of Caldwell, Carolyn Troy of Genesee, and Bill Gosling of Moscow. The bill now heads to the Senate side. The Idaho House Resource and Conservation Committee voted 14-4 today for a bill that would remove the requirement that the Idaho Fish and Game Commission be bipartisan. Currently, no more than four of the seven members of the governor-appointed commission may be from a single political party. The bill came up after Republican Governor Brad Little asked newly appointed Commissioner Bradley Melton to resign earlier this month after someone pointed out to the governor that Melton had changed his party affiliation from Republican to unaffiliated shortly before he applied for the job. There are currently no Democrats on the Fish and Game Commission. Idaho Wildlife Federation Executive Director Brian Brooks noted the state's first citizen initiative created the commission in 1938, and the initiative specifically called for a bipartisan approach because hunters were concerned about undue political influence on wildlife resources. The Idaho House voted 46-23 yesterday to pass legislation that would freeze local government property tax collections for 1 year. Republican Representative and House Majority Leader Mike Moyle of Starr sponsored the bill, which would prohibit all non-school taxing districts from collecting more property tax next year than this year. Individual residents' property tax bills could still increase, however, depending on changes in assessed value. Republican Representative Lance Klo of Twin Falls, who along with 9 Republicans and all 14 House Democrats opposed the bill, said, "We're telling people we're going to freeze the property tax, but next year their taxes are going to go up because of reassessments and tax shifts. That's my biggest concern. We're really not freezing property taxes, and for that reason I can't support it." The Lewiston Tribune reports Republican District 5 Representatives Bill Gosling of Moscow and Carolyn Troy of Genesee voted against the bill. House Majority Leader Moyle said property tax collections would increase by $60 to $100 million next year without the freeze. He said, "My intention was to hold this bill for a while and try to come up with a solution. There have been conversations. Some of the counties have tried to find a solution, but others haven't, and the reason for that is because they think you'll let the bill die." Democratic Representative and House Minority Leader Elena Rubel of Boise called the legislation a misguided attack on local government. Rubel said, "We need to genuinely address the problem and not make it worse. Yes, people need to come to the table. I couldn't agree more. But it's the legislature that needs to come to the table. It's the legislature that caused the property tax crisis." The bill now goes to the Senate side. On an 11-3 vote yesterday, the Idaho House State Affairs Committee approved legislation which would limit voting dates for school district bonds and levies to May and November only. Currently, the state allows local school district elections in March and August as well. Local districts use school bonds for construction and levies for expenses. Passage of bonds and levies often raise local property taxes. Bonds require a two-thirds supermajority vote to pass, and levies require a simple 50% majority. The Idaho legislature stopped using property tax money to fund the state's share of public schools in 2006 and raised state sales taxes from 5% to 6% to replace that money. School districts say the sales tax increase hasn't made up for the lost funds, leading to the majority of school districts asking voters to approve bonds and levies for new money. Republican Representative Wendy Horman of Idaho Falls said, "By focusing on those May and November dates, I believe more voters will participate and be more informed." Horman said more people vote in May and November elections, which means the fewer voters who cast ballots in March and August end up making the important decisions. She said limiting school bond and levy voting to May's primary election and November's general election would result in more voters being engaged. Idaho School Board Association Executive Director Karen Echevarria said the opposite would likely happen, because May and November elections usually have more issues on the ballot for voters to deal with. Echevarria said, "We are worried about voter fatigue. Our electorate is not as well informed because they are more concerned about other issues on the ballot." Democratic Representative John Gannon of Boise said the real problem is the state's failure to adequately fund education, which results in school districts needing bonds and levies. Gannon also said the proposed legislation removes March and August election dates in which voters can vote for and vote to recall elected officials. All 14 House Democrats opposed the legislation. University of Idaho law professor Richard Seaman outlined the legal aspects of the 5G cellular telecommunications rollout at today's Moscow League of Women Voters program at the 1912 Center. He said the telecommunications industry is interested in a rapid rollout of the 5G technology, probably within 5 years, Professor Seaman started by saying the U.S. Constitution gives the federal government the authority to regulate interstate commerce, as well as supremacy under the Supremacy Clause. He noted several acts of Congress giving the Federal Communications Commission authority, including the 1996 Telecommunications Act.
First, it generally preserves the rights of states and local government to regulate wireless internet providers, okay? Local control over wireless providers is specifically preserved by the 1996 Act for the purposes of ensuring public safety, to protect consumers, and, perhaps most pertinently to small cells, to regulate, quote, the placement, construction, and modification of personal wireless service facilities. Small cells fall within the statutory term personal wireless service facilities, and the 96 Act preserves the right of state and local governments to regulate their placement, construction, and modification. So that is the clause that preserves local control. But then, of course, we always come to the but, right? I knew there was a but. But the 96 Act also bars any state or local law that, quote, may prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the ability of any entity to provide telecommunications or wireless services. So any state or local law that prohibits, that may prohibit, or have the effect of prohibiting the ability of any entity to provide telecommunications or wireless services. I'll take a moment to mention one pertinent recent development is the FCC has construed this second provision in the 96 Act, for example, to bar moratoria. You can't impose a moratoria on the deployment of small cells, as far as the FCC is concerned. And then there's a third provision in the 96 Act, also relevant to local governments when it comes to small cell deployment. It requires states and local governments to act on permit applications to install small cells or large cell towers within a reasonable period of time. So it limits the amount of time that local governments have to process applications by these wireless providers to install small cells. The third relevant act of Congress is a federal statute called the Spectrum Act of 2012. And the Spectrum Act is particularly focused on ensuring that states and local governments quickly approve applications for updates to particularly large cell phone towers. This 2012, this third act, is all about the large towers and the fact that they will need to be, already much of their technology is obsolete, so they'll need to be upgraded and switched out. And as we saw in the video, additional antennas or whatever you call them are going to need to be attached to them. And the idea is this 2012 Act specifically limits the amount of time that local governments have, and in fact their sheer ability to disapprove permits to upgrade these large cell phone towers. Basically what the Act says is, to the extent that the service provider is just upgrading the equipment and doesn't change the physical dimensions of the tower in a substantial way, the application must be approved. So this sort of fixes in, you might say, as far as this Act is concerned, when it comes to, I suspect, implementation of the massive MIMO upgrades to these towers that will be necessary.
That's University of Idaho Law School Professor Richard Seaman. Professor Seaman said a September 2018 declaration from the Federal Communications Commission included three new limits on local governments. One was limiting application fees for franchise licenses to the cost of processing the application. Another limits the time a municipality can take to process applications. And another limits aesthetic concerns.
So there's actually a whole level of federal regulations, in particular when it comes to things like putting up utility poles, because the federal government regulates a large portion of the electrical grid, to the extent that utility poles are used to carry power lines and phone lines and things like that, they're actually subject to federal regulation. And a lot of those utility poles are going to be used to put small cells on them, and federal approval is needed, and it's being also streamlined. But I want to home in on the second thing the chairman talked about, and that is this removing state and local barriers, as he sees them, to the deployment of 5G. In this regard, the most important thing that the FCC has done occurred in September 2018, when the FCC issued a decision concerning the applications that local governments typically require for wireless providers to construct, to attach small cell sites in those municipalities. And the September 2018 decision puts three new limits on local governments. So first, the FCC's September 2018 decision limits the fees that local governments can charge for processing an application to install small cells. Limits the fees. Now, there's one article that I've read about this fee limitation said, this is concerning to the extent that, particularly when we're talking about access to the public right-of-way, the fair market value of that access is actually quite high. That's valuable territory. And what the FCC is making very clear is municipalities cannot make money off of these fees. They can charge for reimbursement of the cost of processing them, you know, the staff time, the various procedures involved, but not just as a profit-making venture. So that's of concern. Second, the September 2018 decision limits the amount of time that a local government has to act on an application to deploy a small cell. And this is potentially concerning because, as a practical matter, it limits the opportunity for public input. And then third, the 2018 decision of the FCC limits the extent to which a local government can rely on aesthetic concerns to deny an application. And these aesthetic concerns typically, as the FCC understands them, are embodied in things like zoning restrictions and that kind of thing. And this is potentially concerning because you can imagine situations like in the area around East City Park where you have a lot of old trees and very dense foliage coverage. Well, the small cell, you're going to need a lot of small cells to bounce around, you know, and work around all these blocks. And of course, that's the very type of area where the very dense clusterings of these small cells can be relatively unsightly. And of course, it also affects the downtown landscape as well. Oh, I mentioned it banned, it's already held that moratoria on the deployment of small cells are unreasonable and therefore preempted by federal law. As a practical matter, what this requires communities like Moscow to do is to get an ordinance in place for permitting and regulating these small cell deployments. Because to the extent it doesn't have one, it can't wait. It can't wait. It can't say, hold on, we're holding the phone, let's put a pause button in place while we think about this and trick things out. No, when the first provider comes to town and wants to put a small cell phone, in Moscow, you're going to be obligated as a matter of federal law to act on it within a certain period of time. If you don't have any regulations in place, you don't have a permit application even, you're in trouble.
That's Professor Richard Seaman of the University of Idaho Law School. The FCC says local governments cannot restrict any telecommunications facilities within their jurisdictions due to health concerns. That is reportedly being litigated at this time. Seaman says the FCC is of the opinion that small cell installations are exempt from review under the National Environmental Policy Act and the National Historic Preservation Act as well.
I should mention here, I saw many of you grunting and concerned, because it is a matter of obvious concern. This is the FCC's belief. This is their opinion. Their opinion is that small cell deployments are not subject to NEPA or the National Historic Preservation Act. That's their opinion. Their opinion can be challenged in court. And in fact, this September 2018 decision I mentioned, the major one really that comes to bear on local governments, is being challenged in litigation right now. On one side you have primarily environmental groups and also consumer protection organizations saying that the FCC is acting too peremptorily without sufficient regard to state and local concerns and consumer protection issues and things like that. And on the other side you have, of course, the industry that's saying actually the FCC should have done more to preempt state and local laws. And they have some horror stories. You can imagine what it's like in many places in California, for example, to get a permit to put a small cell, a place like Marin County. It'll take, according to one provider, it took them 2 years, and it hasn't been acted on yet. Okay, so there are some horror stories out there. They're legitimate concerns, frankly. I think some of these communities may be shooting themselves in the foot to the extent they're saying, we don't want 5G. Well, guess what? It's coming anyway. The extent you drag your heels, you're just putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage, possibly. It's one potential viewpoint in any event. So that was a significant decision. And then one last issue the FCC has addressed, I want to make sure I allow enough time, is a subject of many of recent letters to the editor. Does the rollout of 5G create any health problems, right? Because you see in that video, right, that there are all these little waves going around of different wavelengths. It's going to be much more prevalent, right? We're going to be figuratively immersed in this sea of electromagnetic waves of different wavelengths than we've been exposed to before. So the question arises, are there any health concerns about that? Well, the FCC came out with a report December 2019, this is a couple months ago, saying that it was not going to change any of its existing standards regulating exposure to radio frequency, what's known as RF energy. It has existing guidelines that say, for example, access for, you can't be too close to the cell phone tower, for example. If you climb up and you start getting close to the antenna itself, there are these warning signs that say you have to stay away, and there are various levels that the cell phone towers have to obey. But in response to the question of whether any of these standards should be changed because of the 5G rollout, the FCC in December 2019 said no. So, now there are other agencies that are looking at issues of potential health implications of not only the 5G networks, but the technology that's going to be using them. But as of today, there's no federal standard guideline for exposure to RF energy, unlike there are for exposure to various kinds of air and water pollutants. They're just not in place. And I suspect it would take some new federal legislation to allow for that.
That was University of Idaho Law School Professor Richard Siemens speaking at the Moscow League of Women Voters Forum today at the 1912 Center in Moscow. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. A consultant for BDS Planning and Urban Design told Pullman City Council members last night the city's first priority should be hiring a full-time central business district manager to oversee the city's new downtown and communicate changes with the public. The city recently hired BDS Planning and Urban Design to write a downtown comprehensive plan, a job that is almost complete. Consultant Brian Scott of BDS told the council over 100 people attended public input sessions during the time they were writing the downtown plan. He said much of the input emphasized making downtown Pullman people-friendly. According to the Daily News, Scott told council members, "It's about really trying to recognize that your downtown is for people, and to make downtown successful, it needs to feel good to be a person in the downtown and a person that's not in a car." Many who gave public input on the plan said Main Street is too wide and has too many cars and trucks moving too quickly. Scott said the most common public recommendation was to reduce Main Street from 3 lanes to 2, which would provide more parking, including Americans with Disabilities Act accessible parking, on both sides of the street. Scott said this could be done by simply repainting lanes. Other items recommended in the plan include creating a design standard for new buildings downtown to, quote, reinforce the existing character of downtown. The public also discussed parking, and the consultants gave consideration to changing downtown parking limits from 12 hours to 2 to 3 hours and recommended downtown employees and those parking long-term use off-street parking. The plan also recommends reducing Paradise Street to 1 lane and creating angled parking along the sides, which could be changed to parallel spaces if the street became a 2-lane street in the future. Currently, Paradise Street is 3 lanes, all one way, heading east. The plan addressed public safety by recommending the city cut the width of traffic lanes, install curb bulbs, and adjust traffic signal timing. The plan calls for any new trees planted downtown to be further away from building facades. It also recommends installing green stormwater infrastructure. The plan recommends the city plant more trees at High Street Plaza and construct a stage and grassy seating area. The plan recommends the city install a fire pit at Pine Street Plaza and install a prominent piece of art. The plan also recommends expanding Pullman's trail system and possibly building a Colfax to Albion to Pullman trail. Other recommendations included incorporating the train trestle next to Neal Public Library into the trail system and improving pedestrian crossing on Grand Avenue. A copy of the draft of the master plan is available on the Pullman City website. The City Council will most likely review and vote to improve the final draft plan next month. A report from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and Bonneville Power Administration regarding whether the four Snake River dams should be removed to save declining salmon is expected to be released Friday. The Everett Herald reports public utility officials, tribal leaders, farmers, and environmental groups are waiting for the federal report and its recommendations. The 1,000-mile-long Snake River at one time had millions of salmon, and the construction of dams has disrupted salmon spawning. Environmental groups and some outfitting interests say the government needs to remove the four lower Snake River dams to restore salmon numbers. The Snake River dams supply about 3% of the electricity in the Northwest. Snohomish County Public Utility District spokesperson Aaron Sweeney said it's too early to know what impact dam removal would have on utility rates. Besides salmon recovery, dam removal would also have an effect on irrigation, recreation, river navigation, and flood protection. Different options include doing nothing with the dams or completely breaching them. On a unanimous vote yesterday, the Idaho House Judiciary Committee advanced the bill to the House floor, which would raise the minimum age for marriage to 16 years. Republican Representatives Barbara Ehart and Brian Zollinger, both of Idaho Falls, co-sponsored the bill. Idaho is one of about a dozen states which does not have a minimum age for marriage, meaning 16 and 17-year-olds can marry with their parents' permission, and people younger can marry with a judge's approval. Ehart and Zollinger's legislation would require 16 and 17-year-olds only marry someone within 3 years of their age and set the minimum age for marriage in Idaho at 16. Ehart said research showed 16 is the most common minimum marriage age in the country. Ehart said, "I believe we have done a great job moving Idaho forward in saying that we do have a minimum age." Democratic Representative Melissa Wintrow of Boise sponsored a similar bill last year, which a committee killed. Wintrow's bill would have required 16 and 17-year-olds to get a judge's signature to marry. Wintrow voted in favor of the new legislation yesterday, but said she did so reluctantly, saying she thinks the minimum marriage age should be 18 and anyone younger should be required to get a judge's signature to ensure they aren't being coerced by parents. According to the Idaho Falls Post-Register, Wintrow said, "I voted for the proposed child marriage legislation as a first step to protecting Idaho's children from coerced or forced marriage. However, I do feel that there are some loopholes in the legislation that a predatory adult could take advantage of. I want to make sure that we are letting kids reach their full potential, and I am nervous that we might be leaving some of Idaho's children at risk of cutting their childhood and education short." Lawmakers held another bill regarding youth marriage in committee yesterday. Representative Zollinger and Republican Representative Christy Zito of Hammett sponsored that bill to remove the requirement for a marriage license, replacing it with a certificate of legal proof of the marriage contract. The vote to hold the bill in committee, which often kills a bill this late in the legislative session, was 11-6. Zollinger said the state Republican platform calls for Idaho to, quote, recognize traditional marriage without the issuance of a marriage license for those who, for religious purposes, object to the role of the state in licensing traditional marriage. Zollinger said, I don't think we should have to ask the government to ask for approval of contracts of marriage. Opponents of the legislation said domestic violence programs would lose around $206,000 per year if the legislation passed due to the loss of funding from the $15 marriage license fee. Others said eliminating marriage licenses would make it easier for people to marry multiple times. Democratic Representative John Gannon of Boise said, I think that anyone performing marriages should be secure that what they're doing is lawful and appropriate. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Take a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area. Partly cloudy tonight, low 31. Partly cloudy tomorrow, becoming all sunny, high 50. Mostly clear Thursday night and Friday, low 32, high 54. 20% chance of rain after 10 p.m. Friday night. Snow level 5,600 feet, lowering to 3,700 feet after midnight. Mostly cloudy, low 34. South winds 5 to 10, becoming southwest after midnight, but gusting up to 35 miles per hour. On Saturday, 40% chance of snow showers, mainly after 10 a.m. Partly sunny, high 44, and breezy. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Currently 45 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by Glassfemy, a maker of hand-blown glass products on Kamiokan Street in downtown Pullman. You can find Glassfemy on Facebook or by calling 509-332-1971. KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.